My name's Linda and I'm an addict.
Linda.
Oh, bloody hell, that was loud. And I'm a very nervous addict tonight. Quite a new feeling for me. I never used to get nervous. I used to hide behind all these veneers, all these fronts, and never feel anything except loathing the human race and terror at waking up every morning. Anyway, so it's really good to say I'm Linda, I'm an addict, and sit in this meeting and look at all of you. I was looking around just now when we were in the break, and I thought there's at least, honestly, 15 people in this room that I really love, and I know love me. Really good friends. People that I used with in the 70s, people that I was in treatment with in the 2000s, friends that I've done service with, you know, there's all sorts of people that I sponsor here, my sponsors here. So actually I feel really scared, but there's nothing to be scared about because, this is the family that I wish I could have had myself. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for your chair. I thought that was great. And you reminded me of something. The bucket of piss in the corner. Yeah. 1978, Freston Road. Badger will remember. Freston Road. I lived in a street full of squats. All these derelict houses at the back of Latimer Road and Ladbroke Grove. And there was no bathroom or anything like that. So I had a bucket in the corner, a bucket of piss in the corner. And I was 17 years old. I didn't know how to look after myself or empty a bucket of piss. So, and I remember one night lying in bed and the door just being kicked off and it was the police and we got raided. And I lived with this mad Irish bloke called Des who died in 1979. And, you know, it was all fucking chaos. Sorry, I'm not supposed to swear, am I? I don't actually abide with that. I like swearing. Anyway, but I would, because I've always pressed buttons you're not supposed to as well. That's the type of person I am. And I remember the door got kicked off and we got raided and this policewoman came into my room and she lifted the lid on this bucket and heaved. And I can't believe I'm sharing that with you because I was mortified. That pierced the armour somehow. I was mortified. And for years I remembered that. And I'm sure it's on some steps somewhere that, you know, that I actually wrote that down. Anyway, so things are very different now. I have a flushable loo. But, so I'll go back into a little bit of history. I can't remember being under 11 years old, so I'm not going to go there. I'm kind of in therapy for that at the moment. Well, they offered me 6 sessions, and a year and a half later, I'm still there. So we're looking into stuff. There's a lot to be looked into. But I know that I started using, I wouldn't say full-on using, but, you know, my first experiences of getting drunk was when I was, like, 13 years old. And my dad was in the army, and we moved a lot. I lived abroad, and I lived in various parts of Britain. So I was always starting new schools, and I was always a new girl, and I hated it. I was terrified. And I think I remember being, you know, and things I've been told by family members that I was quite curious and shy and sweet as a child. I don't know what happened, but I got to 13 and I thought, bollocks to this. Anyway, so I was the type of girl that would jump out. My dad, after he came out of the army, he had a pub in a really grotty town in Wales. It was depressing, to say the least. And when I was little, we'd lived in Hong Kong, and it was all bright lights and foreign smells and exciting. And to go back to grey, grim 1970s Wales was like, you just want to slash your wrists. Anyway, so, I was the type of person that would sort of jump out of in the pub. There was a roof above the toilets, out the back of the men's toilets, so I used to get out of the window and clamber over the roof and go down and get out and sort of go and drink flagons of cider at the railway line with my friends. And I remember getting drunk and not really liking it because I puked, and I don't like puking. Funnily enough, because I was a heroin addict later on, that's all I did was puke. And I liked it then, because by then it was like it kept the weight down. It's fabulous. Yeah. Bulimic by syringe. It's fabulous. Anyway, so, that was some of the time. I remember that one first time when I really got drunk, and this girl, Janet Sweet, that was there, she passed. She had a fit. She started fitting on the floor. And I was terrified, and everybody was trying to around her, and they were all trying to help her, and I was just like, I remember it being really, really scary, but not, you know, not really liking booze very much. But there was magic mushrooms grew everywhere down there, and there was puff everywhere, and that's kind of what I was more drawn towards. And it's funny, because looking back, I don't think there was ever a time that I can recall that I wasn't going to be a drug addict. I wasn't going to use drugs, and I wasn't going to go down the seedy side of life. I wasn't going to be a shoplifter, and I wasn't going to be a hooker or a clipper or a mugger or a thief. You know, I've been all those things at various times in my life. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was really thrilling. You know, so things went really... went bad for a while. When I was 16, it's funny because when I did my first step four, I'd always put my using down to the fact that at 16 I'd had a child and he was adopted. And my parents thought it was the best thing that should happen, and I was putting mother and baby home run by nuns, and he was taken off me at birth. That was traumatic, to say the least. And it was terrifying for a 16-year-old to go through giving birth on my own and not knowing what the hell was happening. It was really scary. And this was the 70s, you know, 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds were younger then than they are now. And I was the only girl of that age in that whole sort of town, and that was pregnant, that got pregnant, and my dad had the pub, so everybody knew. And, you know, it was like, oh, there she is, that's the Davis's daughter. Look at her, she's up the stick. You know, that sort of thing. Anyway... I always put my using down to that because of that trauma. But when I did my first lot of steps, I discovered that actually it was because of my behaviour for the 3 years leading up to that. That's why that happened, you know. Within 9 months of that happening, I had left Wales. My family was a mess at the time. My dad had been having affairs. My mother had been having affairs. They split up. I'd been kicked out of school 3 months early because my behaviour was disruptive, and I had a fight with the Welsh teacher because they used to cane you in those days and hit you and stuff like that, and I just wasn't having it, so I hit him back and got thrown out. And I always thought that was unfair that he didn't get thrown out for hitting me. About 9 months after that, I was in London and on my own. Relationship with my mother was horrific. My dad had gone off with a dolly bird, and I was sort of just a mess. The whole family was a mess at that time. When I think back, you know, the Queen, when Windsor Castle burnt down, she had her Annis Horribilis. Well, the 70s were the Annis Horribilis in my family. 1976 was the pits for me. It was fucking awful. I've just realised I'm saying anyway a lot. Nerves. I can all hear myself going, anyway. So I was in London 9 months later. I'd left. I was meant to go. This is a story. I was meant to go with... I'd left with the only two gays in the village. Me and the only two gays in my village had left and decided that we were going to go and pick grapes in France. That's what we were going to do. I was wearing cheesecloth and had bangles up my arms and love beads and all of that. I thought I was the biz. Skinny little thing. I was lovely then, back then. Anyway, so I remember... getting the train, we got from Harwich to the Hook of Holland, and when I got to the Hook of Holland, they wouldn't let me in, because they wouldn't let us straight in through France, so we thought, we'll go in through Holland and we'll hitchhike down. So I'd spent, because I've always been unmanageable, especially with money and emotions and everything else, I'd spent all my money, so when I had about a fiver left Act, which I felt was a lot of money in 1976, 77. And got to the border and they wouldn't let me through. They let the two boys through, but they wouldn't let me through. So they locked me in a cell for 6 hours, made me sign a form saying I promised to pay Sealink Ferries the money to send me back, which I never paid, still haven't. Next step 9, that should happen. Maybe not, I don't know. Anyway, it was a long time ago. But my sponsors here giving me dirty looks, so I better pay it back. So they locked me in a cell, made me promise to pay them the money, and I ended up somehow that back then there was little scrubs. There was a place they called Tent City, and it was full of tents. And so I got deported back. How many people get deported from Amsterdam? that's like a badge of honour, isn't it? I was deported from Holland for being a vagrant. Oh, God. So I ended up in this tent in Tent City, and I picked up a bloke on the boat coming back, as you do, you know, you pick up the good-looking bloke on the boat. So he came back, and I remember him rummaging around in the sleeping bag that night, and get off. Anyway, I thought, well, he's getting on my nerves, so kicked him out of the sleeping bag. Then the next day, we sat outside. There was a shop on Holland Park Avenue, and the three of us sat there on our bags because the two boys had come back with me. God love them. Very loyal. They came back with me. And this American guy called Bud, very nice, walked past and he said, are you looking for somewhere to stay? And I said, yes. And he took us to this mansion on Holland Park Avenue. It was 27 rooms in that place, and I squatted there for 9 months, and I had the room at the back, you know, sort of like a Romeo and Juliet balcony with stone steps going down into the back. That was the best time of my life. We used to jump over the wall into Holland Park. It was sex and drugs and rock and roll, but no heroin yet, so it was fun. You know, it was like peacock feathers in the room and pampas grass, and oh, it was fabulous. And I had a real good time there, and I met people from all over the world, and there'd be people eating macrobiotic food and playing guitars and dreads, and, you know, it was fabulous. And I had a real good time. Then I fell in love with the dealer. We all got kicked out of that squat, and I ended up living in Freston Road. That's where the shit hit the fan. And I don't know why, but there was a guy, I'd got rid of that bloke that I was seeing, and there was another one called Keith. Keith was a guitarist. And I'd taken some acid, and every time Keith went like that, all these colourful musical notes would fly across his head. And I remember walking around for about 12 hours going, oh, I love him. Just, I love you, and I love your musical notes. It was just, it was fabulous. Anyway, a couple of days later, because I was now deeply, deeply in love with him, I walked into his room, and he was jacking up. And I said, will you, you know, do me? And he went, no, you've never done it before. And I lied. I went, yes, I have. So he gave me my first hit of smack. And that was it. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved it because everything, all the drinking, all the running, everything I'd been using to not feel what had happened to me, it took all of that away. It just felt lovely. It felt like a big, you know, like a big marshmallowy sort of hug, duvet hug. It was lovely. And of course things went downhill from there on, and I was sort of, I never really liked prostitution. I never really called myself that, although a couple of times I kind of had to, but if I could rip them off, I'd much prefer that. I was not a bad thief. So, and we used to have all these little scams, and I've told people before about these little scams. We used to get these cheap handbags from Woolworths, and there was a hotel in Piccadilly, and at that time, it was just a cheap hotel. The toilets were in the corridors. So you used to get a client, go into the room with them, they'd give you the money, you'd stick it down your jeans or around your bra or whatever when they weren't looking, and you'd say, I'll just leave my bag here, can I go to the loo, and then run off, because there was nothing in the bag. And I did that for quite a while. It's funny how things come full circle, because my home group now is on a Tuesday night in Wardour Street. and is the Ties That Bind Us Together meeting. And it's literally two doors up from Rupert Court. And Rupert Court was where I used to clip. That's where all that used to go on. And this Tuesday just gone, I phoned my oldest sister and I said to her, you'll never guess where I am. Because she had come up from Wales to stay with me on a brief hop. My sister is so innocent. She's never done anything, the oldest one. She's not an addict. She's never nicked anything. She's never done anything in her life. She's lovely. She came to stay with me and I was showing off. I used to show off a lot. It was like, you know, I said, we'll go out clubbing. She said, but we haven't got any money. How are you going to get money? And I said, stay here. Anyway, these two Arab guys have walked up and I've kind of gone, walked up to the end of Rupert Court, said, so, you know, given them the spiel, got the money off them and everything. Went back to my sister. I went, we're going out. And she said, where did you get that? I said, I've just sold you. I said, well, you can have me or her or both of us. And she was like, oh, my God. Anyway, I remember taking her out and giving her speed and everything. God love her. Anyway, I phoned her up and told her about that. She was, oh, my God, that's amazing. I can't believe you're there. And, you know, and now and I'm clean and I'm doing service there and all that stuff. You know, I can be funny and it can be all lighthearted because I don't believe in sort of really wallowing in the misery. I do that enough. But there were some times back then where it was sort of, I suppose I'm giving you where I came from and, you know, the basis of what happened. By the time I was 21, I'd had two kids and I'd kicked a heroin habit. I was living in a hostel, pregnant again with my daughter. And because I'd got off smack, I kind of had to get off smack. You might remember this, but I was in Northwick Park isolation unit with hepatitis, with Hep C, and I remember Badger and Anne coming to see me. And that was many, many, many moons ago. And I came out of the hospital after being in there for a month. I was yellow all over. And, you know, I was close to death and I had a sort of 10-month-old baby and it was hell. I came out, used again, and ended up going back into the hospital. And I don't know, something clicked into place. They were going to take my daughter off me, and I thought, I can't go through that again. I can't lose another kid. I can't let that happen. And somehow I found the strength to not do it. I drank a lot, and I used a lot of sleeping pills and a lot of Valium, and I snorted Whiz and I took Blues and Diconol and all sorts of other stuff and Tunol, all of it, but I didn't go back to heroin. Somehow or other I sort of kidded myself that I was clean because I wasn't injecting heroin anymore. So I kind of fooled myself and I carried on this sort of road of, you know, I got a flat, I had this daughter, I was a single parent, I got involved with a couple of married men because my self-esteem was so low, I couldn't, God forbid, you know, going on what you said as well, that I could allow anybody in to really love me or to let me really love them. It's so sad, really, you know, the waste of love that you give to people who are undeserving, because that's all I knew. I didn't think I was worth any more. So I used to, you know, look for people that just that mirrored what I thought about myself, really. So that went on for decades. And the last sort of 10 years before I came into recovery, I'd got involved. It was my 39th birthday. I'd met someone who was 15 years, he was 24. Dealer, moved him in. That's what you do, you move him in. So I was having this party and he came along to sell and I thought, oh, he's cute and he's got a pocket full of drugs, he can come home with me. That was that. So I moved him in, things went downhill rapidly. You know, we were smoking crack together, we were taking coke, crack. It was all sort of every drug. So I don't want it to sound like a drug-a-log, but it was sort of everything. And I kind of knew I was in trouble again. I thought, this feels like it felt before, and I don't know how to get out of it. I spent 2 years walking around Hyde Park, because I live over that way, I live near Notting Hill Gate. I spent 2 years walking around the park, crying my eyes out, wanting to be out of that relationship and off the drugs, and not knowing how to do it. Just not, I hated myself. There was no scrap of worth or love there for myself. There's a guy that I know that's in AA, and he said to me, Linda, there's a place for people like you. And a few friends that we know were in that fellowship, and one of them, he said, Linda, there's a place for you. It's called NA. And I said, will you take me? And he took me to my first meeting. And from that meeting, I remember going to my doctor and saying to him, I've been smoking crack for the last 6 years. And he was lovely. Somehow this doctor had kind of, he didn't judge me. He just said, you've been hitting yourself with some really heavy chemicals. You're going to need help. So I said, okay. And then he got me in a sort of day program. But the first meeting I went to, they gave me this. They gave me one of them. It's a lovely colour. You can really see rocks on that very, very well. Because that's what I did with my first one. You break it all up on there, take lines off it, everything. I thought, yeah, it stands out. Very good, lovely. So that's what I did with that first book. And I was one of those addicts that instead of getting skinny towards the end, I'd gone up to like over 21 stone. I was like this bloater because I'd spend days and days and days smoking crack. Then I'd go out shoplifting and spend days and days and days eating, coming down from it. And then repeat that all over again. I was really, really sad, really bloated, really unhappy. And I carried on for about another 6 months. And then I remembered something must have gone in that first meeting. Something funny happened in that first meeting. Actually, not funny, it's quite sad. But there was a guy there that shared. It's quite a posh meeting, you know, Notting Hill, darling. There was a guy there and he said, you know, I said, I've just come back from Jamaica and I was locked in a cupboard smoking crack for a fortnight. And I thought, that's fantastic. He's got my life. I want to be in Jamaica smoking crack in a cupboard. You know, that's just like, oh my God, it sounded like heaven. Oh, seriously, in all seriousness, that sounded like heaven to me at the time, like a treat. So that had gone in somewhere, but it was very funny because in that first meeting, I'd worked in brothels for 12 years as well. I know my story goes from bad to worse, honest to God. I'd worked in brothels for 12 years. I did my first step four in a knocking shop. Can you believe it? No, this is honest to God. Did my first step four, sat there, the phone would ring, and I'd go, yes, we've got a lovely young lady here today, 36, 24. You what? What do you want? Fuck off and put the phone down. And then carry on with my spiritual step four. That's what I did. Honestly, I can't believe it now. And I thought that was all really normal. I thought that was okay. That's how messed up I was. I thought it was all normal and all okay. Where was I? I've gone off track. Where was I? Brothel, Jamaica. Yeah, no, we've left Jamaica. Yeah, meetings, that's where we're getting to. We're getting to recovery. Recovery from the madness. So, I'd gone back to... I went to a meeting. Something had gone in and I thought, no, I think they might have had something in this meeting. Because this guy also shared that he had been in the gutter looking down his nose at everybody. And I thought, oh, my God, I do that. I've done that. I used to come out of work in the knock-in shop and deliberately walked to the bus stop to hail a taxi so the plebs at the bus stop could see me hailing a taxi. That's how low my self-esteem was. I thought, that, yeah, look at me, I'm fantastic, I'm hailing cabs. You're waiting for London Transport. Suckers. You're probably going to work as well. Fucking hell, something wrong with you all. Anyway, so I've gone back. I came back to a meeting. And I sat there. That's why I mentioned the knocking shop. Because I walked into the first meeting I went to on my own, and there was a guy there that had put the cards up in the phone boxes for one of the knocking shops I worked with. And we used to call him Junkie Jay. Junkie Jay, we had the cheek to call him, because he was still on heroin. And there was all us like, ah, fuck. So he was there, and he was 7 years clean. Junkie Jason, 7 years clean. How did that happen? And then a guy that I used to use with, it was shagging one of my neighbours, and he used to come around. We used to have sessions in my flat. The sessions were always in my flat. And so he was sat there, Lee. He's like 20 years clean now or something mad like that. And it was just, you know, it was just... It was sort of walking in and people going, hi, and there was knowing nods as if to say, you finally got here. And I carried on in my own suite where those first few months. I didn't listen to any of the suggestions because I was off my rocker. I was threatening people. This woman held me by the fingers during the serenity prayer and said, I don't like what you shared. I said, I'll rip your fucking head off. Talk to me like that again and I will batter you. All of that. I mean, and I was walking down the road going, I'm going to drink because of her. The anger because of her. I was so angry. I was livid, raging when I came into recovery. Oh, my God. So I threatened her. And a few other people, and I used to share. People used to share in meetings, and I'd go, I've got to go to another meeting now. The shit I've just listened to. The self-pity. There's people in cancer wards, and you're moaning. There's people dying, his children haven't got food. I used to say all that. I used to do all of that. I think Bev can testify. I was sicker than a small hospital, I think the phrase is. One of the other good things that happened in one of those early meetings, there was a man in this room that I mentioned earlier that I used with in the 70s. We used to hide our drugs for him because he was worse than the rest of us, though. About a fortnight in, I was sat in this meeting, Portobello Road, and this bloke, I looked at him and I thought, is he off the telly? I've seen him before. Anyway, I opened his mouth and he said, my name is such and such, I'm an addict. And I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, I hadn't seen him for decades. The last time I'd seen him, I ended up in Norfolk Park Hospital with hepatitis because we'd used. And I went up to him. When I was using, I was a skinny little, because I used to vomit all the time, skinny little thing with blonde hair. Now I'm like this bloater, like that. I was sort of walking in. And I said, you won't remember me, but I'm Linda. And he said, oh my God, you know, I think you were 18 years clean then. And I said, I'm 2 weeks clean. And you gave me a hug and sent me texts every day after that. So that was like a higher power moment, because I knew if he could get clean that I could do it. I knew that. I thought, my God, because I thought he'd been dead years ago. So that was something, that was a real higher power moment for me. I was in this treatment sort of day program place. And, you know, as you do, you fall in love with every man in there that's half decent looking, got any teeth. You think, oh, well, he'll do, he's all right, I'll take him home, he'll be all right. You know, you bat your eyelids and you sort of kind of, you know, it's all normal, you think it's normal. Anyway, so I ended up following this one around, you know, and he used to come up the flat and we'd do, you know, all of that. And flirty, ended up smoking crack with him again, and, you know, it all went downhill. So I sat in that meeting in Portobello Road. I couldn't have been more closed down. My legs were crossed, my arms were folded, I was like doubled up on myself almost. And I thought, this is not working for me because I'm not working it. And it says it works if you work it. And I really wasn't doing any of it. I wouldn't make tea. I thought, riffraff, not making tea for any of them. I'm not getting any woman to sponsor me. I don't trust them. They're all bitches. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. It was resistance, resistance, resistance. When I finally went back to that meeting and thought, it's not working because I'm not working it, things changed from then on. I started putting pen to paper. I started to share as honestly as I could at that time. Now I know it wasn't real honesty, but it was the best that I could do at that time. You know, you come in off of the using I'd done, your brains are fried, and you normalise the madness. carried on in my recovery. I went back to college, thank you. I never went to college in the first place, but I went to college. I studied drama. I was the only person on that course that got an agent. I did some telly, I did some theatre. You know, this was me. It was too much. It was too much for me. I couldn't accept it because I still hadn't done the work on myself entirely. And as usual, a man came along, told me I had nice legs, moved him in, the low self-esteem again, and I ended up using with him. He was in and out of the rooms. I ended up relapsing after 7.5 years clean. I came back. I was in this meeting, and I'll tell you exactly when it was, because I'm celebrating a clean time birthday this week. I'm 5 years clean again. Cry. Why did I say that? I'm saying that because it's a big deal, but I know it was 5 years ago that I walked into this room, and I'd been back out there for 8 months, and it was boring more than anything. You know, like using is just boring. Like, I'd got rid of the fella because he pissed me off. He wasn't giving me what I wanted. So, you know, I'd got rid of him. And I was just sort of drinking and using by myself at home, you know, slobbed out in front of the telly. And I thought, you know, I deleted everyone in the fellowship off Facebook. They'd gone long. I was sat there with my vodka going, well, they're a twat and they can go. And this man, I could fucking stand her, delete. You know, I was like, oh, yeah, absolute bonkers. And so that was the boring, depressing 8 months. So it was 5 years ago I came back into this room. I came into this room and there was a guy here called Bob D doing the chair. And he talked about self-obsession and just thinking constantly about yourself and your needs and what you want. And I remember sitting and crying my eyes out, but knowing that this man knew. He knew how I felt that day. He knew. And, you know, there's people, good, dear friends of mine that are in this room, like Annie and Bev and Trisha and lots and lots and lots of people that were here at that meeting. And my current sponsor, I remember her walking up to me and looking at me with such intelligence and warmth in her eyes. Because I didn't, you know, I survived out there. I'm a survivor. I know a bullshitter when I see one. You know, I know. So and I saw her and I could see in her eyes and I thought, I like this woman and I like that woman. And there's, you know, two of you have sponsored me at different times in here. And I've got a lot of love now for them and a lot of people in this room. And things have been very different this time. If I had a feeling in those first 7.5 years, you see, I know the difference between being clean and being abstinent. I was abstinent the first time around. I wasn't clean. My behaviours were off the Richter scale. If I had a feeling, I'd go out shoplifting. And I would sit in meetings and I'd go, do you know what you need to do? You need to get on your knees and pray. You tell everybody what they needed, but not, you know, I hadn't softened up, I hadn't opened up. None of that had happened. This time round, if I get a feeling, I pick my pen up, I do my steps, I phone my sponsor, I talk to my friends when I can. I've travelled a lot in recovery. I toured around India with Annie for 6 weeks when I was 6 months clean. That was 4.5 years ago. We went to all around South India and we had a ball. We laughed solidly for 6 weeks and drove scooters and went nuts. Didn't we have a ball? I travelled around Thailand with Trisha in recovery. You know, we had a fantastic time. So fantastic, they came back and I stayed there on my own. That's the kind of thing I do now. I travel, you know, I go to college, I talk to people, I go out for dinner with friends. I'm quite posh now, apparently. And not bad from a hooker from the 70s, is it really? And yeah, it's just this last year, As there's a saying in my Tuesday night home group that people say all the time, getting current. I hate it. It makes me think of currants and raisins and stuff. I don't know why, but we're going to get current. This last year has been like the year from hell in my life, but not in my recovery. This time last year, my uncle died. I was very close to him. 6 weeks after that, his son, my cousin, died. And then in November, my mother died. And that was all very sudden. She got taken into hospital. It took 2.5 weeks to find out she had an acute and aggressive form of leukemia, and she was dead 3 weeks later. It's been hellish. And it was... I was really rocked by it because I had this really bad relationship with this woman, and to spend that last few weeks watching someone die that you were terrified of is a big deal. And I learned in that last week that I loved her. I learned that she loved me. It's been a lot to go through. Instead of picking up, I've done things so differently this time that one of my friends does these moonlit, silent walks every full moon through Epping Forest, and I thought, I need to do that. I need to go and feel some nature. I love nature, and I need to go and do that. And so I started doing these moonlight walks with her, and I found that really, really healing. I was so in grief. I was so out of my own body. I just felt mental, and I was in meetings, I was crying a lot, I was freaking out a lot. People listened to me, and I've spent... Is time up? Yeah, thank you. And I started... I'll leave it on this, because this is one of the most important things. Step 11, it's a step, not a suggestion. I've been doing meditation for the last since all that stuff happened. I thought I needed something. I found a healthy something. I've gone to my local Buddhist centre. I'm not Buddhist, I'm secular, but I joined my local Buddhist centre and I do meditation now. That has helped me as much as NA. That's helped me doing my step 11, has really, you know, being around like-minded people and soft and gentle people. One of my really good friends who's 30-odd years clean said, Linda, you need to surround yourself with people that love you and that are gentle and kind. And that's what I've done. And it's really, really helped me. I'll leave it there. Thank you so much for listening to me.